Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind. Our present speaker today, again, is Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, Bible and Government and Apologetics. Ron, we ended last time in our 12th session. We were talking about Joseph and his brothers in Egypt, which is a fascinating story. So maybe you give us a brief review of the story to date that we're going to continue.
As we related last session, Joseph had been sold into slavery by his envious brothers and taken to Egypt, where he was sold to Pharaoh's captain of the guard. And over a period of years, he was able to rise to a very high position in the government because of his intelligence and ability to interpret dreams. What vaulted him into prominence was his interpretation of one of Pharaoh's dreams, which he interpreted as meaning that that part of the world would experience 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. So the king put him in charge of making ready for the famine and administering the distribution of the stored grain during the famine. Jacob, now his name is changed to Israel, sent all of his sons except the youngest and favorite Benjamin to Egypt to buy grain. When they came before Joseph, he was able to conceal his identity because they didn't recognize him, although he recognized them. We gave several reasons for that during the last session. He had them return to their homeland to fetch Benjamin, who Jacob very reluctantly permitted to go. And we'd gotten to the place at the end of the last session where Joseph had revealed himself to them at a banquet held in their honor.
Okay, and of course the dream of Pharaoh was about seven fat calves and seven fat cows and seven lean cows to predict the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine. I remember that in grade school. Well, Ron, didn't this frighten, obviously, the brothers of Joseph when they, after all they'd done to him, sold him into Egypt and told his father that he was dead?
Yes, it did. He said to them, and I'll quote here quite a bit as we go through this story from the Bible itself in the book of Genesis, "Come near to me, I pray you." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph." See, now he's revealing himself, "whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve me, to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all of the land of Egypt. Make haste and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. There I will provide for you. For there are yet 5 years of famine to come, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty. And now your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth that speaks to you. You must tell my father of all my splendor in Egypt and all that you have seen. Make haste and bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. This story is found in Genesis 45.
It's one of the surprising and fascinating stories, how Joseph is reconciled to his brothers. Well, how did Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, respond to this news? that Joseph and his brothers were reunited.
Well, Pharaoh was very pleased. And he told Joseph to send his brothers back to their homeland with wagons to fetch his father and family, as well as all of their herds and flocks. He promised to provide them with the best land in Egypt, the land of Goshen, which is in the eastern Nile Delta region. Following Pharaoh's orders, Joseph gave his brothers wagons and ample provisions for the journey. The Pharaoh also gave them festal garments, that is, you know, fine garments. And to his father he sent 10 she-asses loaded with grain, bread, and provision for his father on the journey. This story continues again in Genesis 45.
Okay, so in Genesis, we're continuing, and when they got home, how did Jacob react to all of this startling, impossible news to believe?
Well, at first he didn't believe him, that his long-lost son was still alive, because he thought, of course, he was dead, and that he was a ruler over all of Egypt. It certainly is a fantastic story. But after they told him all that Joseph had said, and when he saw the wagons and gifts Joseph had sent, his spirit was revived. He said, quote, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." So after God told him in a vision not to be afraid to go down to Egypt, he and his entire family journeyed there with their flocks and herds and other possessions. And as they approached Egypt, Jacob sent Judah, that's I believe the fourth son, ahead to announce their arrival. Joseph went out personally to meet his father and family in his chariot. And of course, they had a joyful reunion. This story goes on in Genesis 46. After meeting and blessing Pharaoh, Jacob and his family and herds and flocks settled in the land of Goshen, as Pharaoh had promised them. And I said this can contain the best land in Egypt. It's located in the northeastern Nile Delta region of the country there. The Bible tells us that, quote, "Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt." That means, of course, Jacob and his family. "In the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and were fruitful and multiplied exceedingly." That goes on into Genesis 47.
Don't the Amish, or some such group of people, talk about coming in the land of Goshen, or the land of plenty? I'm trying to think what group that is, that I've read about them at various times. But I don't think until now I had really realized that Goshen was in Egypt.
Right, it was up in that northeastern corner of Egypt, right?
Real fertile land.
Yes, it's all, where the Delta spreads out, the Nile River spreads out into like a fan over, maybe 100 miles or so or more.
Okay. Well, what happened to the Israelites, Ron, after they were settled in Goshen, this wonderful place that Joseph had prepared for them, some of the best land in Egypt?
After 17 years, Jacob blessed his sons, especially Judah, from whom the Messiah was to come, and he died. And he was taken back to Canaan to be buried with Abraham and Isaac, as he had requested. This story is told in Genesis 49 and 50. In regard to his burial, Jacob said, quote, "I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham brought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were purchased from the Hittites." When Jacob finished charging his sons to draw up his feet, he drew up his feet to the bed and breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Jacob remained, renamed Israel by God, was 147 when he died.
You know, he used to think those ages were maybe to be interpreted in a different way, but I know a fellow where my sister is at St. Paul's in Indianapolis. He was 104, he's up every day playing the piano. And so I think we're getting those ages again, are beginning to even, all kind of people, it seems, in our culture, living to be at least 100. And so the ages don't surprise me like they used to. Well, Ron, what happened to Jacob's remains after his death?
After Jacob's body was embalmed in the Egyptian manner, wrapped all up in, like mummy wrappings and all that kind of thing, preserved. And after a period of official mourning, his mummified body was returned to Canaan, attended by a great procession, which included his sons and many Egyptians. A fitting epitaph of Jacob was made by one scholar who said,
This is an interesting statement about Jacob.
Yes, it is. He says, quote, "From the facts stated here, Jacob had a very mixed personality, characterized by avarice, selfishness, ambition, worldly prudence, and expedience on the one hand, instability, purposeful foresight, unflinching labor, diplomacy, humility, thankfulness, and dependence upon God on the other. His character was mellowed and softened with age, and his better qualities overshadowed his lesser ones." You might recall we gave several instances where he was duplicit with other people, including, of course, his brother.
Esau stole his heritage, yes, from him by trickery.
And then later on, of course, with his uncle, Laban, when he went back to fetch a wife in Mesopotamia.
So he was a, as you said, a mixed personality.
Yes.
A lot of faults, imperfections, but also a lot of good qualities. Okay, what happened to Joseph and his brothers after their father died?
After Jacob died, they became frightened again, saying, quote, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil which we have done to him." So they sent a message to Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, forgive, I pray you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, because they did evil to you. And now we pray you, forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." I didn't say, quote. At this, Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Fear not, for I am in the place of God. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he reassured them and comforted them. This story goes into Genesis 50. Scott Hahn says of this matter, quote, "God had managed to bring good out of evil. Joseph's brothers had betrayed and sold him, but God had used the betrayal to save the whole family. For that reason, early Christians saw Joseph as a type of Christ. Jesus Christ would also be betrayed by his own people, and God would use that betrayal to save the very people who betrayed him." And then I'll quote from the Catechism on this same issue. Quote, "In time, we can discover that God in his almighty providence can bring a good from the consequences of an evil, even a moral evil, caused by his creatures. It was not you, said Joseph to his brothers," this is quoting what we quoted a while ago, "who sent me here, but God. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive. From the greatest moral evil ever committed, the rejection and murder of God's only Son, caused by the sins of all men, God by his grace that abounded all the more, brought the greatest of goods, the glorification of Christ, and our redemption. But for all that, evil never becomes a good." End of quote. In various classes I teach at John Paul, we talk about, one of the biggest questions people have is, why does God let bad things, evil things happen to good people? And a lot of people have lost their faith because of that over the millennia, or have failed to gain faith in the first place, because they just don't have an adequate explanation for evil. And St. Thomas Aquinas, probably more than anybody else, stressed this idea that, well, God allows evil to bring good from it. And that's all well and good, but we could also give a number of other reasons to punish people, because that's what they deserve in some circumstances. And what
purify people, bring them back to God.
Sure, to bring them back to Him like a father, a loving father. But even beyond that, as the Catechism just suggests, beyond that is still a great mystery that we can't understand. But what I've found from my studies over the years, that the Catholic Church is the only institution in the world that has a satisfactory answer for the question of why is there evil in the world.
And even though it's not complete answer to the problem of evil, it is a reasonable insight into why God does permit evil to happen, even to good people. And it's one of the real questions that continually plague a person. I know people who left the church because a child was killed in an accident, and they just couldn't understand how in the world God could have allowed that, didn't cause it, but how He could have allowed that to happen. So it's a real struggle, and I've always used that example of Joseph. When he said to his brothers, well, what you had intended for evil, even determined evil, they wanted to kill him, they wanted to get rid of him, jealous of him, but that God had worked it out to good. So I think it's a wonderful example for us to hang on to, but we still have to trust in God in times of difficulty. Well, tell us about Joseph's death in Egypt. The story continues.
The Bible tells us that Joseph lived 110 years. He saw his son Ephraim's children to the third generation and his other son Manasseh to the second. And Joseph said to his brothers, quote, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land which He swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath to the sons of Israel, saying, God will visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. And they embalmed him, that is, of course, in the Egyptian way, and put him in a coffin in Egypt. That story goes on in Genesis 50. And all this happened about 1800 or 1700 B.C., somewhere in that range.
Okay. Well, wasn't Joseph's body taken back to his homeland much later?
Yes, it was. He was about 40 when his father died. So since he died at 110, he would have lived at least another 70 years or so after his father died. He looked ahead to the time when his people could return to the Promised Land, and he wanted them never to forget this. Even though he was buried in Egypt, he still wanted his bones to be carried to his homeland someday, when his people were to be brought out of the bondage that was to come after his death, many years after his death, in fact. St. Paul says of this matter in his letter to the Hebrews, quote, by faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. That's found in Hebrews 11:22. The presence of Joseph's bones among them constantly reminded the Israelites of God's promises they would return to the Promised Land one day. His instructions were carried out about 400 years later when the Israelites left Egypt, when Moses took his bones with him. That story's told in Exodus 13. After another century after the Exodus, Joseph's bones were buried in Shechem in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver. And it became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. That story is told in Joshua.
Okay, so that's a long time later, 400 years after Joseph dies, that his bones are finally taken back. So
longer in the United States has been in existence.
Golly. So that was really a look into the future.
Yes.
That his bones would be taken back eventually. Okay, as with his grandfather Isaac, Hadn't Joseph been considered also a type of Christ?
Yes, that's true. Many Christians over the centuries, such as the great second century theologian Tertullian, saw Joseph as a type of Christ. Because just as Joseph was betrayed by his own people, Jesus was betrayed and rejected by his own people too. Moreover, just as Joseph saved his own people, Jesus came to save his people as well.
And sometimes they add there that as Joseph was sold for 20 pieces of silver, Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver by Judas. Is there anything else you want to say, Ron, about the book of Genesis before we go to the wonderful book of Exodus?
Yes. First, I want to say that we won't go into every book of the Bible as thoroughly as we did Genesis. We will Exodus, but not most of the books that follow that. And we spend so much time on Genesis because the stories contained therein are so foundational to salvation history and to the Catholic faith. In fact, many of the principal doctrines of the Catholic Church, certainly the doctrine of the creation and the fall and the beginnings of the redemption, are found in Genesis, especially the first 12 chapters. For example, we won't systematically go over each of the wisdom or prophetic books because we would never get through our story. But we will consider these books only as they fit into the historical context of salvation history. So we will have a lot to say about prophets, and we will have a lot to say about the Psalms and other things as well, but we won't go in lots of detail on it. Also, I'd like to close Genesis by saying that the reigning Pharaoh at the time was from a people called the Hyksos, who had conquered Egypt at least 100 or so years before Joseph. They were a Semitic tribe from the north, they were related to the Hebrews. Their armies moved with great speed because they employed war chariots, which the Egyptians themselves adopted for conducting warfare. The descendants of Israel prospered until the Hyksos were overthrown and driven out of Egypt. And the Hebrew people fell out of favor with the new Egyptian Pharaoh, of course, and were quickly forced into semi-slavery, at least. 70 people had originally gone down to Egypt, that is, you know, Jacob and his family. And over a period of 400 years, they grew to a great number. I read estimates of from 200 to 400,000 by Moses' time, even more, but I've also seen much, much smaller estimates, and we'll come to that issue a little bit later in the series.
So whatever the Exodus was, it was a great number of people when Moses led the people out from Egypt. Let's fast forward, Ron, and pick up our story at the time of Exodus, after which the second book in the Old Testament is named.
We pick up the story of the Hebrews, or the Israelites, named after Israel. Again, about the year 1250 B.C., although I have read of estimates as early as 1450 B.C. The story of Moses and the freeing of the chosen people from slavery in Egypt is told in the book of Exodus. Well, there's quite a bit in the other books, the first five books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and which Exodus, of course, means departure or exit. The Israelites had greatly increased in number over the preceding 400 years, perhaps to several hundred thousand people. The Catechism says of this time, quote, after the patriarchs, and we mean by the patriarchs Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, God formed Israel as his people by freeing them from slavery in Egypt. He established with them the covenant of Mount Sinai. Through Moses gave them his law, so that they would recognize him and serve him as the one living and true God, the provident Father and just Judge, and so that they would look for the promised Savior. End of quote.
So as we're going through this history, Ron, from Genesis now into Exodus, we're talking about how God is preparing through history for the Savior, the deliverer, or the liberator. That's why we're calling it salvation history. how it started in the beginning. And so far now in the series, we've discussed several covenants or agreements between God and humans. So let's take a little quick review of those covenants. They almost go like in concentric circles, out from one person and into a family and so forth.
As we said in an earlier session, the redemption of mankind or humankind occurred in stages. God gradually built up his church, that is his family, in salvation history. And he started the redemption by making covenants or sacred agreements with a couple, Adam and Eve, we find that back in Genesis 3:15, who represented the entire human race to come. Then with the family, Noah and his family. Then with the tribe, Abraham, and then renews this with Isaac and Jacob and the chosen people. And now we're ready to discuss God's covenant with the nation, Moses and the Israelites. And later in the series, we will discuss God's covenant with David and his empire. And finally, when we talk about the New Testament, the entire human race was included with the new and everlasting covenant made between Jesus Christ and his Father. Each covenant progressively added more peoples to God's chosen people until the entire human race was included, or at least invited to be members.
Okay.
God, well, just one other little comment here. What happens is God's family is getting larger and larger as more and more people are included in each successive covenant. And God's family, of course, is the Catholic Church, in which all humans are directly or indirectly now members, or at least they're invited to be members.
Okay. Well, that brings us up to the fascinating story of Moses, one of the most challenging and fascinating stories of how Moses survived and became a prince in Egypt, and then the leader of his people through Exodus. We're coming now to the wonderful story of Moses, and that'll be next in our sessions as we continue salvation history, the Old Testament, the story of creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind. And this has been our 13th session, produced for us by Ron Eldred, teacher at John Paul II Catholic High, and your host, Father Larry Moran, the chaplain at the Carmelites, just south of Terre Haute. To our listening audience now, we say, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.